Okay, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about that. I am at MIT, but I'm a visiting research scientist at Google. So they pay my salary, so they get top billing. And let me get out of that projector. Okay, so now I don't know what I'm doing. Okay, let me go over here. Okay, so here is my introduction to quantum computing. A conventional computer takes bits as inputs, strings of zeros and ones, and outputs, strings of zeros and ones. And a quantum computer takes little spins, which are up and down, and inputs them and outputs an answer to the problem, which hopefully is the same as a conventional computer would get, except that it uses quantum stuff to go from the input to the output. And the reason that I am putting that slide up is because what I'm focusing on here today is going to be using a quantum computer not as a simulator of physical systems, not as something you might use to calculate a critical, measure a critical exponent or some property of a phase transition, but rather as something which is used to solve the kind of problems which computers traditionally want to solve, which is to get a string that answers a computational problem. And so that's the model that I'm thinking of here, not simulation. And the kind of problem that I wish to talk about is combinatorial optimization. And I'm going to review what this is for you. This is a situation where you have n bits. And the n bits can take 2 to the n values. But I didn't try this thing. Let me see if this works. Does something depress? You know what to press? Oh, thank you, thank you. Yeah. So anyway, so the idea is that you have n bits and m clauses, and you can think of a clause as a constraint on the subset of the bits. And then what we're going to have is a cost function, which depends on the individual clauses. There are m clauses, and each cost function is going to be a 0 or a 1 depending on whether the string satisfies the clause. So each clause looks at the string and says, happy or not, satisfied or not. And usually the clauses only look at a few of the bits. And the goal in combinatorial optimization, is to find a string that maximizes this function. And in general, this is the mother of all computer science problems. If you could solve this in general, efficiently, if you had an efficient algorithm for this, it would mean that you could solve the traveling salesman problem and all other difficult combinatorial search problems. Not all, but many, many. And so this is a very, very tough problem, but it's kind of the thing we keep our eye on. And when I say solve, I mean you have a computer program which, given the clauses as input, outputs a string which maximizes the function. So the input is the set of clauses. Okay, now, of course, there is a maximum to this, which is the true max it can achieve. And I'm not so interested in that today. I'm interested in what's called approximate optimization. And approximate optimization means that you're looking for a string which doesn't truly find the maximum, but maybe just does a good job. And in this case, you know, looking for the best solution may actually not be a good strategy if you're just looking for a good solution. Sometimes the best is the enemy of the good. And then this is a situation where I want to keep that in mind. Okay, so is the context clear, what I want to do? Okay, fine. So now I'm going to tell you about a quantum algorithm that attempts to do this. So the quantum, this is an audience which I hope is familiar with the basics of quantum computing. So we're working with n qubits. I'm in a 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space. And I have operators, which I imagine I can build, which act in this Hilbert space. And one operator, now that I'm going to tell you, I'm going to make ingredients for the algorithm, is u. This is a unitary that depends on the cost function. You know, it's always weird you call it the cost function because I want to make it big. So it depends on whether you view yourself as the buyer or the seller. if you want to do that. So I guess I'm the seller. That's why I want to make the cost high. But no, not so high they don't buy it. Okay, anyway, I don't know. Do you like my font? If anyone would like to find out how to download it, send me an email. Okay, so... So now I would consider a unitary operator that depends on a parameter gamma. So it's e to the minus I gamma c. And this is a unitary since c is a diagonal matrix in the computational basis. Oh, I forgot to say that. I really am thinking, I should have had a slide for that, that the cost function on the previous page was the way I defined it, it's defined in the z basis. So if the z basis is the computational basis, it's already diagonal in that basis. And so I probably should have had a slide where I said u of c acting on z is e to the minus I gamma c of z times the state z. Okay? So anyway, but note that this operator, e to the minus I gamma c, can be written as a product over the clauses. So, and if my clauses only involve a few bits, this is a product of few qubit unitaries. The other object I want to look at I call B, which is the sum of the sigma x's. Typically, we use the letter x to represent sigma x. So it's just the sum of the sigma x's. You can think of it as a magnetic field in the x direction. And I want to imagine applying this for a time beta or for an amount beta. And again, this can be written as a product of single qubit unitaries because all of these commute, just like all these commute. And now I have a state, which is the starting state, which I want to take as the superposition over all possible strings. So, and this is all, these are all easy operators to construct in the language of standard quantum computing. Okay, so now what I want to do is I want to pick an integer p. And I'm going to pick a set of p angles gamma. The reason they're angles is because those clause functions were integer valued. So it makes the parameters are just angles. So I pick p gammas and p betas. Now I want to construct a state that depends on gamma and beta. And that state is act with u of c gamma 1, then u of b beta 1. Alternately, I act with these two operators. So I have now a state which depends on 2p parameters, okay? And I've been very specific about it. And now note that the required circuit depth here is at most mp plus p, so this is not too deep if you go back and think about it. Now I want to consider a function which is the expected value of the cost function in the state gamma beta. So to give you a sense of what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a state, a quantum state, and I want to make the state so that it drives the cost function up. My goal is to maximize the cost function. So anyway, just think of this function, which for fixed gamma and beta is the expected value of the cost function. Now for any angles, gamma and beta, excuse me, I misspoke. For any p, there is a maximum over all the angles of this function. It's just the maximum over them. And I don't want you to think of p as big. I'm actually going to be talking about p equals 1 in a minute. So just think of p as a small number, 1, 2. I'd like to be able to analyze if it was log n or grew with n, but for now I want you to think of p as a fixed small number, maybe 1. So then there would be two angles here, and for these two angles, there's a maximum over gamma and beta of this function. Now note that if I, mp is bigger than or equal to mp minus 1, and that's because the maximization at any p the maximization at p minus 1 can be viewed as a constrained optimization at p, where I set the last two angles equal to 0. So this can only go up with p or stay the same. And actually, we can prove that in the limit, as p goes to infinity, there are angles such that the limit of mp is the maximum. But I'm not really interested in p goes to infinity, but we can prove that for as p goes to infinity, there are a set of the angles which will maximize the function. They'll solve the most difficult problem. But that's just a math fact, which I don't want to dwell on, but it's just a fact. So, but you see that as p increases, you only get better, and if you went forever, and P you could do perfectly well, assuming you could find the angles. So now what I want to talk about is a quantum algorithm with angle search. So you fix P, start with angles gamma and beta, so I have two P angles. Use the quantum computer to make the state gamma beta, and measure to get a string Z, and then you can compute C of Z. So again, you fix the angles, you build the unitary transformation, you act on the state, you measure, you get a string, you read out the string value, and you then write down C of Z. Now what I'm going to do is keep doing that for the same angles until I get a good value for the expected, a good estimate of the expected value. Remember, this was the expected value of the state of C in the state labeled by gamma and beta. So I get a good estimate. Now what I do is I repeat with new angles. I change my angles. So that's going to involve some kind of strategy for picking new angles. And people have been talking more and more in quantum computing about having a system where you run the quantum computer to make a function call, and then you have some classical way of imagining how you change the angles to make a new function call. So that's what I'm imagining doing here. The quantum computer is like a black box. It produces values of the cost function, and then you change the parameters in order to do a good job and repeat with new angles to get near that. Now, that sounds kind of generic, but let me just give you an example, which let's look at max cut on three regular graphs. So what max cut is I give you a graph. A graph is an abstract thing. It has n vertices, and it's and what's specified when I give you the graph are the edges, which vertices are connected to which. And what we want to do in max cut is a computer science term, but basically I want to assign a plus or minus to each vertex to maximize the number of edges on which the bit values disagree. That's what max, if you could think of it as an anti-ferromagnet, you could think of it as finding the ground state of an anti-ferromagnet. But in this situation, I'm always going up. The reason I'm always looking for a maximum is because I'm going to talk about the approximation ratio. And it's very important when you talk about an approximation ratio that the denominator isn't zero. The denominator has... So anyway, I'm maximizing. So again, the goal is to put down plus and minuses and to maximize the number of edges where there are disagreements. That's your computational task given the input, which is the graph. Now, let's think of an algorithm for this, random guessing. If you randomly guess string, you just randomly guess it, you'll satisfy each edge with 50% probability. Okay? Does that make sense? And now that is a provable algorithm which gives you a 50% approximation ratio. Random guess. Now, in 2014, I, along with Jeffrey Goldstone and Sam Gutman, showed that the P equals 1 version of the QAOA achieves a approximation ratio for this problem of 0.6924 for all instances. Now, the reason that was somewhat significant, in my opinion, is that we were able to prove this result for all instances, no matter how big. So this is a provable worst-case performance guarantee. And it's very, I don't think that ever happened before in quantum computing, that anyone had a provable worst-case performance guarantee, except for very, very contrived problems. But this is for just any old max cut problem. Yeah.
Did the algorithm specify the angles? Or did you...
Oh, yeah. I was going to talk about that. For P equals 1, we found the angles by hand. For P equals 1, we found the angles. And I'll mention that in the next page. In fact, by doing math, we calculated the angles for P equals 1. And in fact, that's the next thing. But let me just point out something. This is not better than the best classical algorithm. But this problem has a very interesting history. For many, many years, no one could improve on the 0.5. And then finally, the Goemans-Williamson algorithm improved on the 0.5 and got 0.87 for general graphs. And that was a huge breakthrough in computer science. It's not the algorithm in that case, which is so amazing, it's the fact that they can analyze it for all instances. That's the hard part, is to do the analysis. So anyway, So let me just mention that for fixed P, we can actually classically pre-process and determine the best angles in advance. But I don't think I have enough time to go through this. So let me just trust me that for fixed P, there's a way to determine the angles in advance. But the cost of that grows dramatically with P, although it does not grow with N. It doesn't grow with the number of edges, but it grows with the, excuse me, I misspoke. It doesn't grow with the number of vertices, but it grows with the depth of the circuit for this three regular thing. So, and P equals 2, I know the answer for P equals 2, but it's still not as good as Goemans-Williamson. And but I don't know what happens if I go to higher P because I can't analyze the damn thing. I'm sorry? No, in this case, we found the angles, calculated them in advance. Yeah. Yeah, so it's different. Instead of doing a search, in this case, we used math, we found the angles, we plugged them in. We optimized the function by hand. Now, you would think that if I could optimize the function by hand, I would have a classical. Yeah, but I know, but don't forget, I'm solving what's considered an easy problem. But I know something's bothering you about that, but what is it?
I'm just confused.
Yeah, okay.
What?
Well, in this case, you would, you can find the angles by yourself, but it doesn't give you the string. So what you do is you then determine the angles, build the quantum circuit, hit the state, and then you get, and the quantum computer gives you the string. The calculation in advance does not produce the string. It only produces the angles, which is kind of weird. Yeah. Oh, well, on three regular graphs, then it's like 0.9 something.
Okay.
You know, it's beyond Goemans-Williamson. Well, Goemans, you know, here I'm restricting to three regular graphs. It's up in the 0.9s, okay? But I don't know the number. Okay, so I'm not going to show you how I do this because I'm not. Okay, but I just want to tell you one other thing about this. Is that the 0.6 on random guessing is not as good as the best classical. But let's look at another problem, what I call the ring of disagrees. You just have a ring. And now, this is an easy problem to solve. I mean, you know, I know the answer, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus, you know, up, down, up, down, up, down. That's the best thing. But the QIO gives an approximation ratio of 2 plus 1 over 2 plus 2, independent of n. But the reason I'm saying that, what's interesting about that, is if you look at p equals 1, the approximation ratio we get is 3/4. What is that n? We get 3/4 n? Oh, you see the stupid computer. When it deleted the d. Terrible. So anyway. But what I want to say about this is that 3/4, you might have said to me, the way you're getting the 3/4 is you have like a 3/4 probability of producing the best state. That would be one way that you might get the expected value, but that's not what happens. What happens here is every string that you measure satisfies 3/4 of the bonds. So this is not a failed perfect optimizer, which is just working some of the time. It's always producing strings which satisfy 3/4 of the bonds. And if you go to P equals 2, it satisfies 5/6 of the bonds. And that's really different. And the reason I'm emphasizing that is this is an approximate optimizer, which produces approximate solutions, not with low probability, very good solutions. Now, I want to tell you another little story here. It's about Maxi 3 Lin 2. This is a problem where I have n variables and m equations, each with 3 variables. So now think of the zi's here as zeros and ones. And so I have zi, and so each equation is of the form zi plus zj plus zk mod 2 is a 1 or a 0. So now, the instance is specified by a collection of triples and a 0 or 1 for each triple. In other words, I tell you, bits 7, 9, and 20 should add up mod 2 to a 0. And I specify this list. Now, it's easy to see whether this is satisfiable by doing Gaussian elimination. So the task is not to see if this is satisfiable, but in the case when it is not satisfiable, it's to find a string that maximizes the number of satisfied equations. Now, in this case, it's NP-hard to find the optimal solution, so we're going to try to find a good solution. So basically, this is some other problem, which involves three variables. Okay, now, it turns out that if you look at let's talk about approximate optimization for this problem. Let me give you an algorithm, classical algorithm. Guess a random string. Now, if you guess a random string in this problem, you will satisfy each of those equations with 50% probability. So guessing a random string gives you a 1/2 approximation ratio. Okay? Now, amazingly for this problem, as a result of the PCP theorem, if you had an algorithm which guaranteed an approximation ratio of 1/2 plus epsilon for any epsilon, no matter how small, that would imply that p equaled np. So what that says is that you cannot, for this problem, unless p equals np, do better than random guessing. That's an amazing result. And now this is true for any instance, but now what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a hint. I'm going to tell you that every variable is in no more than d equations. So I made a restriction, but once I give you a restriction, I've given you something. And with that restriction, in the year 2000, there was an algorithm that got 1/2 plus constant over d approximation. This does not contradict this, because if you make d big, it'll fall below the epsilon. So there was an algorithm due to Hostad in 2000. And then in 2014, I, along with Sam and Jeffrey, produced showed that the p equal 1 version of the quantum algorithm that we just had achieved 1/2 plus constant over d to the 3/4. And this beat this. So at that moment, we had a provable, we had a quantum algorithm with a worst case performance guarantee, which was exponentially better than the best classical algorithm for the same problem. So we were kind of pleased with ourselves. A little too pleased, because then Scott blogged about this. and the result of that is that 10 computer scientists got together and said, so it's 10 against 3, and the 10 of them produced a classical algorithm that got 1/2 plus constant over d to the 1/2. Ah, so off, you know, we were ahead briefly, but then we looked at it more carefully. Well, and we still then and we ch- we then did better analysis, but we got 1/2 plus 1/101 d to the 1/2 log d. So we still have this stinking log. But so we're off by a log relative to the best classical algorithm. But you know, I think it's pretty interesting because we can show that on typical cases there's no log. And also it may be that if you go to p equals 2, we do better, but we can't analyze it, it's too hard. So when do you do it? Okay? And you know, can we get rid of the log d entirely? Well, maybe. But if there exists an algorithm which gives 1/2 plus constant over d to the 1/2 for a sufficiently large constant, then p equals np. So we're in the weeds here, worrying about constants. But anyway, that's the status of it. But so let me just tell you another thing. The QAOA exhibits quantum supremacy. And this is work I did with Aram Harrow. I have to be fast because I'm almost out of time here. Okay, the QAOA exhibits quantum supremacy. What that means, I'm sorry?
You have about 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. So what that means is this. Suppose that I consider this state, which is a p equals 1 version of the QAOA, and then I compute for each z, I don't compute, there exists a probability of producing a string q of z. This is the probability that the string z is found after you measure the state, which is a QAOA p equals 1 state. Now suppose you have a classical algorithm which flips coins, and it has the property that it will produce strings with the probability distribution p of z, so it flips coins and out comes strings, and this probability is close to this one, in this sense, very close, point by point, then you can show the polynomial hierarchy collapses, which means that this thing cannot be, at least in this, with this very stringent measure of success, this thing cannot be simulated on a classical computer unless the polynomial hierarchy collapses. And this is, our proof is basically just stole the proof of IQP and put it here. Another thing I want to say about is fault tolerance, that this model, again, I don't have a lot of time. So I just want to say something, a little work I did with Adam Buchatz, who was my student, and Peter Shaw. What we showed is, I just want to make one point here, because I don't have a lot of time, that a lot of times people talk about fidelity. They say, I have to have good fidelity in order to have a successful algorithm. But that's not really the case. What you really need in this case is that you have a good chance of producing a string which with a good value of the cost function. Fidelity can be too strict a measure. For example, suppose you have 1,000 bits and each of them is off by 1%, then the fidelity relative to what you want is like cosine of 1 degree to the n, which is essentially 0 as n goes to infinity. But still, that string has a lot of information in it. And what we could show is that in a very simple noise model, that the fidelity does not go down. The approximation, the fidelity goes down exponentially in n, but the approximation ratio is reduced by an n-independent factor. So that's kind of good, because it means that it's not degrading the approximation ratio, even though the fidelity is. And I think that's important to remember when you talk about error correction and building quantum algorithms. It may be the case that the properties that you want are not that sense, are more insensitive to fidelity. And so that's important, I think. So let's talk about a more general approach. The more general approaches have different angles, beta, for every qubit. I only remember that when I did p equals 1, I had the same angle for every qubit, and I had the same one angle for the whole cost function, but I can have different angles for everybody. So I can open up the search space. So you might imagine that the way I'm going to run my computer is to have a sequence of unitaries which for each clause and for each bit, not just use that big one. And so I have tons of angles, L angles, and L two-qubit unitaries, each of which depends on that. Now, for example, suppose we look at a near-term quantum computer which might look something like this. We have a grid. So then you might then say that the experimentalist is handing us something where we have a grid, and on the individual nodes I have single-qubit unitaries, and between them I have two-qubit unitaries. I have a toolkit of unitaries given to me by the experimentalist. So then what I can do, and the depth is, of course, limited by the device coherence. So then what I can do is I can make a state which comes from this. And I can then try to maximize the cost function just using the parameters that were handed, using the unitaries that were handed to me by the experimentalist. And with Sam and Jeffrey and my collaborator at Google Hartmut Nevin, we looked at the QAOA and MaxCode on three regular graphs. And what we were able to show is that even if the unitaries sit on a grid which is not matched to the target, okay, so the grid, we're implementing unitaries only given the, we're implementing transformations where the unitaries are given to us by the experimentalist. And yet the cost function we evaluate by measuring strings and then measuring it, we could prove that in this case, with two angles, we could get a provable approximation ratio of 0.53. And again, that's better than random guessing in its worst case. So it meant that it's not hopeless to try to run a variational algorithm where your variational algorithm is built with things that are not necessarily the objective function. Okay? Now, and this approach solves the embedding problem because I'm not embedding the cost function into the problem. That's a big problem at D-Wave, right? They're always worried about how do you get the cost function into the graph. But anyway, so the paradigm here is after producing theta, measure to get a string Z and classically compute C of Z, pick new values theta and try to go uphill. Now, you know, will this work? I don't know, but I know that when we did simulations of small quantum computers that let 16 bits with 160 parameters, that we were able to get very high approximation ratios for max cut. And we were able to find them. So what I would say is that what we need to do with the near-term quantum computer is accept what the experimentalists give us, produce states that depend on the parameters the experimentalists give us, try to vary those parameters to do something like optimize a cost function or maybe minimize the energy of a Hamiltonian. And then I would like to advocate just running and seeing what happens, even in the absence of provable results. Because it may turn out that when you just do it, you learn something which you would not have learned otherwise. Now, there's another thing here. You know, you can start to think of this as the engine for a quantum neural network, where, you know, you might think, okay, I'm going to use this process, this sequence of unitaries as a way of transforming a state, and somehow or another I read out an answer which may correspond to a label in if I'm trying to classify data. And I'm investigating that now with my collaborator Hartman Nevin at Google, the question of whether we can use this paradigm as a way to do machine learning. And so that's another thing which I think you might be able to do if you have a fixed quantum computer. And I don't know, I wrote as a quantum brain. I don't know, even know what that means. I don't know what does that mean. Who knows? Yes. The answer is that a quantum brain, yes. The answer to every question is no, but in this case I'll say yes. And that's my talk. No time left. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Eddie. So yeah, we'll now take questions. And Bill Pfefferman will be helping handing out microphones as well.
So that it all works perfectly when p goes to infinity, that's the adiabatic algorithm,
in essence,
right?
Yes.
So to which extent, if you take p to be small, is that, to which extent is that running the adiabatic algorithm too fast? Is that?
I don't think it is.
It's the difference?
Because if you run the adiabatic, I don't have a good sense. I mean, a lot of people have said, you know, what you've done is trotterize the adiabatic algorithm. Because if you look at the adiabatic algorithm, you have an application of a cost function and a driving Hamiltonian, and you turn on the cost function as you turn down the driver. And if you trotterize that, meaning write it as a product of unitaries, each of which depends on, let's say, the driver and the cost function, that looks like the QAOA. But I don't know, if p equals 1, it doesn't look a lot to me like a trotterization of that algorithm. And you can also show, I don't know how to answer that, except I think at very low p, I don't think it really does look like that. And obviously, you see, if I vary the parameters, I can only do better than the adiabatic, because I can make better choices. If I have a different parameter at each time, then I can only do better. Yeah.
I have a question about, it's pretty remarkable that even such a small p works, but suppose I take p to be some function of number of strings, suppose it scales with, let's say p is a log n or something.
Yeah.
Do you suddenly get every problem is solvable? I mean, is it?
Well, I would love to know that, you know, obviously. But you know, I can analyze p equals 1. I can probably analyze p equals 2 for max cut. I've done it, but.
But there are no results where p is some function of.
There are no results. No, no one looks at this. But you know, no. I mean, my intuition is that it may look. I didn't show you how you analyze the algorithm. I didn't have time for that. But if you actually analyze the algorithm, what you do is you look at a clause, and then you kind of look at the neighborhood of the clause, which is kind of the light cone of it, sometimes it's called. It's the things that are connected by the operators. And as you increase p, that spreads out in the graph. So when p is log n, you touch the whole graph. So I think that I should say on the ring of disagrees, Elizabeth Crossan pointed this out to me, but she told me this, but then I didn't hear her, or she told it to me in my presence, but I didn't register it until she reminded me afterwards when I rediscovered it. That. But she did. So anyway, if you look at the ring of agrees, I told you that as you increase p, you have a approximation ratio of 2 people's 1 over 2 people's 2. But as soon as p is n over 2, so that your light cone closes, the approximation ratio jumps to 1. Once you see the whole graph on the ring of agrees, the approximation ratio jumps. So it may be that, once you see the whole graph, that you do better. And that's why I think they should run this on a near-term quantum computer. Because look, if you're at 100 bits, the log of 100 is not that big. You know, even if you're at 1,000 bits, you may not need that big a depth in order to really get to the place where there's a chance that the thing is really exploring the problem. So that's why I like the idea of log n, but I'm powerless so far to analyze that. I do numerics, but it's very hard, you know, when you do 20 or 30 qubit numerics to know if, and you have the log of 30 as your parameter, is that big? I don't know.
Question here?
Yeah.
So yeah, you explained this hybrid method where you have your quantum device that you use to estimate the cost function and then you vary the parameters. Mm-hmm. You think you can maybe streamline this? Like it seems like maybe you could estimate the gradient directly on the quantum computer. This looks like a magnetic system.
Yeah, that might be that you could to do the search. You might want to calculate gradients. You know, certainly in machine learning, very often the algorithm is driven by gradient estimation. You know, to do gradients, you have to do, if you do it by finite differences, small differences, you have to do things very accurately. There may be situations where you can evaluate operators which give you the gradient. There are many other things which we could talk about here, maybe there are better ways to get the gradient. I don't know. Uh-huh. Chris.
You emphasized in the ring of agrees that you always get good output. So the distribution of things that you would measure was good approximation ratio things. It was sort of over there.
Not good. They are what they are. 2 p + 1/2
Okay. And so what is? So that's all of them. So you don't ever get anything less.
You don't get anything more either.
Oh, okay. So what about in the? What are the results about that actual distribution?
Oh, I have a concentration bound. I can prove that for fixed p, if you have a problem where you have some kind of bounded degree graph, that the variance of the distribution of the cost function grows like the number of clauses. So the standard deviation grows like the square root of the number of clauses. So that means we have proved a concentration bound in general. And that means that the phenomenon I mentioned there is actually, it's an example of something which is more generally, I just said it. The variance of the C is M, and that's small.
A very silly question, but I'm a bit confused about this monotonicity with P. So I see that if you find a global optimum, that's necessarily monotonic with P.
Yeah, that's right. That's all I said.
But if you're in the game of sort of trying to find sort of foremost cases, then the enlargement of your space might actually kick you to sort of perform less.
Well, no, you're never going to perform. I mean, there's something called a greedy, you could adopt what's called a greedy algorithm, whereas for, let's say, a fixed value of p, you find your angles. Now, if you start your optimization at p, the next value of p, with those angles fixed and add 2 more angles, you can only do better. Those are called greedy algorithms. They don't work well. I have explored that numerically. They're not really that great. But no, you can always adopt a strategy which guarantees that you don't go down.
So you don't like reset after adding the...
No, if you do reset, then you might make it worse, obviously. No, not obviously, excuse me. I didn't mean obviously, I meant badly. Too bad on you. But you don't have to do that. Was there another question?
Yeah. Sorry, I want to ask a very naive question.
Sure.
You showed there several cases where the classical algorithm is better.
Yeah.
So naively, I would have thought I can realize the classical algorithm with a quantum computer. Why is that not the case?
Oh, yeah, no, because any classical algorithm can be rewritten as a quantum algorithm, but I meant this quantum algorithm. I'm really comparing this quantum algorithm run in this fashion to the best classical algorithm run in a different manner. If you want to take that best classical algorithm and put it on a quantum computer and run it in a, as just, you know, in a very naive way, I agree that the quantum computer could achieve that. But I'm not talking about all quantum algorithms. I'm only talking about this quantum algorithm. Only talking about this, nothing else. Okay?
All right. Any more questions? If not, I have a quick question.
Sure.
So if you, what exactly is the complexity of solving for the angles again? If you have a certain value of P, then you need to solve for these angles, these gamma and beta angles.
Yes.
So what's the exact computational complexity of solving?
I don't know whatever the exact computational complexity is of maximizing a function of continuous variables. You know, and so what's something that's amazing, though, is if you look at machines, sometimes, you know, it turns out that if you, you might luck out. I think the way you luck out is this. It's because, it's just what happens in machine learning. In machine learning, you have millions of parameters, okay? And if I told you, you're optimizing a function over millions of parameters to tell whether there's a dog or a cat in the picture. Now, you might say, that's insane. You have millions of parameters. How are you going to find the optimum? But you don't need to find the optimum. All you need to find is a good solution. And there can be zillions of good solutions. And I've seen that in the numerics. So it's not, I think that the only, one of the hopes here is that if you go to high P, or you go to having a lot of angles, that you're not, when you do your angle search, you find angles which do a good job, and that they're one of many, many, many local broad minima, and you can hone in on them. And so I don't know, you know, but to think about searching for the best of, you know, a million continuous variables, obviously that's too hard. Yeah.
In your paper for low P, you do the search using a classical computer.
Yeah.
And didn't you show that if you discretize, then you can find the best angle?
Oh, yeah, I think we did show that in our paper, yeah. We showed that if for low P, independent of N, that there were no needle-sharp valleys in the landscape, so that the search could be polynomially efficient. Yeah, I forgot that. Thanks.
And maybe one more question.
If I am already at the optimal solution of a specific kind of trivalent graph for the max cut, and then I make a perturbation, could your algorithm help me to stay at the nearest possible to the optimal while propagating the perturbation?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, when I looked at the starting, in this problem, the way I specified the initial state is as the uniform superposition over all possibilities. But you could say, why start there? Why not just start in a string which has been output by the best classical algorithm, and then you can only go uphill from there? And that is a strategy. But I tried that with small-scale numerics on my laptop. It didn't work so well. It didn't move. But it's very possible that a strategy like that could be adopted. And we have other ways of thinking about that, which are actually in the paper. Actually, that is discussed in the paper by me, Goldstone, Gutman, and Nevin, how to adopt a strategy where you start from the best classical solution and then attempt to go up. We discussed that. So look in that paper. We tell you what to do.
Thank you.
Sure.
All right, great. Let's thank the speaker. Thank you very much.